Hi, friend. Do you love academic books but hate the price tag that goes with them? Me too. That's why you need to learn more about Hannover Press. If you're not familiar, we're an academic press guided by over 40 seasoned academics and pastors that publishes original Protestant academic theology and reprints classic Baptist literature with the quality of a university press and the ecclesial focus of an evangelical publisher, all for the right and appropriate price. We have several exciting titles in the works that you're going to want to check out. So if you don't know about us, go to hannoverpress.com to find out more. On this episode of The London Lyceum, we talk with Dr. Tobias Flattery about the ethics of AI and robots. So we cover all sorts of topics like what is technology ethics, why is it important, how advanced are robots becoming, why would other countries potentially grant citizenship to robots? So does being sentient actually provide something of a moral status for something? In the same way, does that mean robots should have moral status, especially if they can never become sentient? But what if they can? And what's the Kantian argument for indirect animal rights? Is there empirical evidence that there's a causal link between treating things like robots badly and my acting badly? Does my committing virtual killings in a video game, for example, dispose me to actual negative actions in real life? And much, much more. As always, if you have thoughts about the episode or ideas or requests for the show in general, hit us up on Twitter or Facebook or check us out at our website, thelondonlyceum.com. Now for the only analytic Baptist and confessional podcast on the planet, we think this one's going to get you thinking. Well, I'd like to welcome all of our listeners to another episode of The London Lyceum. I'm one of your hosts, Jordan Stefaniak, and we are a podcast that's dedicated to serious thinking for a serious church. And in trying to inspire serious thinking, we've tried to encourage or cultivate an intellectual culture of things like charity, curiosity, critical thinking, and cheerful confessionalism. We think these sorts of virtues can help aid us, particularly in our polarized age where we are pulled to extremes, where we don't want to expend any charity or curiosity on what other people think and why they think it, or even cool intellectual, interesting intellectual problems that may unearth new solutions to old problems. But we also think that that doesn't require us to completely be brainless, where we exercise no critical thinking and don't actually engage in serious, rigorous thought. We think these things can go together. So hopefully we encourage both of them at the same time. And in doing that, in the podcast, we talk to all sorts of people about all sorts of things. And that's what makes it fun and hopefully helps us to grow in these different virtues. Now, I'm excited to introduce you all to Dr. Tobias Flattery, and he is at Wake Forest. And so he's just down the road from me. So this should be exciting because this means that I can go drive down and bug him about the questions that we talk about here sometime. We're going to talk a little bit about tech ethics, AI, robots, all sorts of fun things. I think these are all super interesting questions and things that, for whatever reason, I mean, I talk with people about this stuff way more than you would think. So even I work a normal, regular, boring job in a large office building, and you talk to people who have nothing to do with any of this stuff. And for some reason, everybody wants to talk about technology and all the stuff that goes on with it, because it actually impacts a lot of stuff that you wouldn't think about. So this should be fun. So Tobias, before I do say anything else, tell me a little bit about yourself. And then what was it that really interested you in thinking about these various things?
Hey, Jordan. Well, thanks so much for inviting me on the podcast. I'm really excited to be here. I'm a professor, as you said, in the Department of Philosophy at Wake Forest in North Carolina, so not too far from you, which is cool. I did my PhD in philosophy at Notre Dame in 2020. So I finished just before the COVID pandemic hit everybody in the face. So I work in technology ethics. I teach and research in tech ethics, but also in early modern philosophy, especially Leibniz, for example. And then quickly, you know, before that, I worked for a number of years in an office environment like you. So in the private tech sector, as a I was a data warehouse engineer. So, you know, large databases meant for analysis, and I did business intelligence sorts of things. Yeah. So you asked also why tech ethics, right?
Yeah.
So that was kind of a late development, really. So as you might know, you know, you get into a PhD in philosophy, for example, and you have all these general thoughts and you're interested in the perennial questions, and then you have to decide to specialize in something. And so for me, that turned out to be early modern philosophy, but I also needed to do some teaching, and this was back in 2019. And I thought, you know, I have a technology background, even though it's super rusty and dusty. So I thought these technology ethics questions are really interesting. Students will like it. So I started to teach on it kind of before it was cool. And, you know, talking with students, thinking about problems with them together sort of got me into writing. And so now I'm kind of doing both things, and I've been doing that since then.
That's awesome. Sounds like we have a little bit of a similar background in the technology aspect. Been doing various technology jobs with my company for a while, including business intelligence. And I'm always the annoying guy who brings up the sort of questions that you seem to be engaging here in some of these papers. So maybe just start, like, I mean, when we think about the field of technology ethics, where all does that touch? And why? I mean, I think it's somewhat intuitive why it's important, but just give me that little elevator pitch.
Yeah. I mean, so I'll give you the quick sentence on why, then say something about the field. So tech ethics is important because it forces us, you know, to think hard about making sure we take morally important problems seriously in the context of using and developing technologies. That's the basic idea. But so technology ethics is kind of a broad term for a broad field of diverse folks, academics and researchers from different fields who are all trying to understand and address ethical questions arising in the context of using and developing technologies, usually new or emerging ones, right? I mean, what makes the field kind of interesting and vibrant is that there are folks in different fields. Also, this makes it chaotic and sometimes maybe a little incoherent. But you've got philosophers working in the field, legal scholars, social scientists, computer scientists, artists, and other kinds of people. So sometimes we talk past one another, but it also can lead to richer discussion. But I'm a philosopher, so I focus on like moral philosophy questions arising in the context of these technologies. But you also asked why it's important, right?
Yeah.
So, I mean, I think the field's important because for reasons that any applied ethics field is important, right? Any area of human life, any institutions or human endeavors come along with interesting, sometimes sort of idiosyncratic moral questions, right? So you're interacting with animals or you're doing sports or business or war or whatever. And there are interesting moral questions that kind of pop up. And so tech ethics folks try to help us think more clearly about that. And then if necessary, to try to encourage us to change our practices where necessary. You know, I think innovation, like it always outpaces careful thinking. I mean, and some of that's understandable, right? Because you have these cool benefits to these technologies that are making us want to develop them, like cars that can take us places without us having to drive, or you know, robots that can give us friendship or companionship or whatever it might be. So we stomp the gas pedal, and tech ethics folks kind of want us to look at the bigger picture and tap the brake pedal here. And so sometimes that makes us unpopular. We're like storm crows, you know, like Gandalf from Lord of the Rings. You know, whenever he comes around, you know, there's bad news and you know his suggestions are going to be inconvenient. But that's, I think, why tech ethics is important broadly.
Yeah, that makes sense. I mean, there's all sorts of other things that are inconvenient that are clearly things that we should do. So you mentioned a little bit about robots. I want to talk about them, especially just given your work on that. So part of my question at this point is just how advanced are robots becoming? Because in one of your papers, you mentioned Saudi Arabia granting citizenship to one, which seems just wild to me. Why would they even do that? That seems obviously they must be really advanced. So what's the rationale for doing that at that point?
Yeah. I mean, just on robots, I mean, robots are getting more and more advanced. And it's hard to talk about robots without talking about artificial intelligence. You know, we're not in like typical science fiction territory. We don't have Data from Star Trek or like Ultron from the Avengers or the Terminator yet. We do have some robots that kind of resemble the droids and, you know, the Star Wars prequels. So we've got Boston Dynamics has this human-shaped anthropomorphic robot named Atlas that can do all these, you know, really complicated physical maneuvers, barrel-twisting jumps and dancing and stuff like that. Tesla also has a robot called Optimus. Kepler is a new one. They're impressive, but they're not generally capable, autonomous, intelligent robots yet. You've got lots of robots being deployed in healthcare and service contexts. So you've got elder care robots. You've got food delivery robots on college campuses, like all over the place now. Moxie is this new robot that is kind of like a cute little Pixar character robot that is like a social emotional coach for young children. So you've got a lot of development here that's pretty impressive. Now, why did Saudi Arabia in 2017 grant citizenship to one? So Hansen Robotics, this lab that developed this at the time, pretty impressive, you know, human-shaped robot called Sophia. Although now, with the advent of all of this large language model AI, it's a little crude seeming now. They developed this robot, and Saudi Arabia says we're going to give it citizenship and kind of announces it. And you know, everybody freaked out, of course. You know, some good reasons being mentioned, like Saudi Arabia's track record for you know, not giving women the kinds of rights that men have and things like that. And here we're giving a robot citizenship. Why? I don't know. I mean, I only know what I read in the news. And it frankly seems like maybe a bit of a publicity stunt to advertise their tech sector. But I don't really know what drives them. I mean, Japan in the same year gave a legal residence permit to a chatbot, which I don't know if they take that very seriously.
So, I mean, a lot of the moral status of robots you're dealing with in these essays, and I mean, that seems like the really interesting and important question, along with rights, and a lot of it seems to go along with whether they're sentient or not. Mm-hmm. And I guess why number one does that level of ability, why would that grant something moral status?
Yeah, that's a good question. So maybe we'll say real quick what. At least I mean, and many of us in applied ethics discussions mean by the term sentient. So the term sentient in kind of popular media and popular discussions is often used to mean like full consciousness and intelligence, just like us and all of that. But in applied ethics context, not just in tech ethics, but in animal ethics and other areas too, really what sentience just means is the conscious ability to experience pleasure and pain, you know, or joy and suffering, right? So that's kind of, so it's a conscious, you have to be conscious for that. You have to be able to have experiential states, but it's really just pleasure and pain. You know, if you like positively or negatively valenced experiential states or whatever. So that's what sentience means. And let me just say what moral status means, because this is, you know, a point of sometimes confusion too. By moral status, I just mean that you matter for moral decision-making. Like you're part of the moral community, you count. And, most people have thought, most philosophers and most people have thought that that pain and pleasure are respectively good and bad. And so if you can feel those states, then, you know, you matter for morality. We should try to prevent pain from happening and encourage pleasure in its various forms from happening. So roughly speaking, that's why lots of people think that sentience brings along with it moral status.
Mm-hmm. So this might be a little bit off track, but as I think about moral status just in general, my traditional framework is to say like everything has some degree of moral status. Even, you know, the trees and the flowers outside have a degree of moral status. It's just a different level of moral status to where, yeah, it's probably wrong to, you know, just chop down a tree for the fun of it, but it's not to the degree of you're going to get jailed or something, unless it's that famous tree over wherever it was that somebody just hacked down for the fun of it. That seems like a greater moral crime because of its significance. So when I think of like a graded level of moral status, it doesn't concern me so much to even just think about the robot conversation. Is that the way most people in tech ethics are thinking about robots, or is it more of a flat, everybody's kind of like on the same plane as far as what moral status means? Does that make sense?
Well, I'm sure it does. Maybe I'm just misunderstanding or failing to, but so it might be that you have a kind of, well, so I should say that the moral status I'm talking about here, we might also call it intrinsic moral status, right? So if you are a sentient being on this common view, you matter for moral decision-making because of what you are in yourself, mm-hmm. Not because of your relationship to other things. So you might think that, you know, your car has moral status in the sense that if I were to go smashing your car, you know, you, Jordan, would be very sad and it would make life hard for you. But that would be a kind of indirect moral status. So when I say moral status here, I'm meaning intrinsic moral status. Yeah.
Yeah, that makes sense. Because I guess what I'm thinking about is like when I think about should robots have moral status or not, I think a lot of people, at least the people that I'm aware of, would want to think, why would we give them moral status? They're just a machine. But there is some level of like, well, what if we describe moral status not so much in terms of how you're thinking about it with me or with, you know, your neighbor kid down the street, and think of it more along the lines of like, other objects have moral status too. It's just not the same. They don't have the same sort of rights as
a
person would have.
Yeah. So I think most people, understandably, you know, very reasonably resist the idea of thinking that a robot should have moral status. If by that we mean like it because of what it is, matters for our moral decision-making. It's just a robot. It's a hunk of metal, very complicated, but in the end, it's just a thing. It's just stuff. It doesn't have a mind. It's not sentient, and so on. So that, I think, seems pretty darn reasonable. Now, of course, if robots ever came to have like true sentience, like actual conscious experiential states and that sort of stuff, I think it'd be really reasonable to say, well, then they're going to have intrinsic moral status. They will matter. But so in the paper that you mentioned, you know, I just assume that robots don't have that kind of status. So I agree with that. But there are still people that think, yeah, that's right, but we might still have good reasons to protect robots, to give them rights, at least in the sense of saying we should have like legally enshrined or at least strong social norms to not damage or harm them. And that's sort of like the argument that I'm thinking about in this paper. Yeah.
Which is super interesting. So like explore, like, cause I think intuitively a lot of people would think, why is that even the case?
Yeah. That we should give them rights. That seems
crazy.
Yeah.
If they have none of these features, then why would we go to the trouble of creating legal systems to give them rights?
Yeah. So the philosophers that have advanced this, so I should say in my paper, I advance and try to explain this argument in a way that folks haven't as comprehensively as before, but I do defend it to a certain extent. And I do raise a problem for it. Now, philosophers, of course, are squirrely funny people. So, you know, do I in my heart of hearts, you know, think that this argument gives us reasons to give robots rights? Well, you know, do philosophers have hearts? I don't know, but it makes it hard for me to say that I would go that far. I do think it gives us a moral reason if you accept the argument itself. So that's just a preface on that. So this argument that gets advanced is kind of traces its roots back to an argument or at least a reason that Immanuel Kant, a very famous 18th century philosopher, gave for why we shouldn't go kicking dogs, despite Kant thinking that dogs don't actually have moral status, intrinsic moral status. So do you want me to start with that and then kind of work your way up?
Yeah.
So Kant was interesting in that he thought that sentience was not sufficient for moral status. He thought, yes, dogs, cats, other animals are sentient. They can feel pleasure and pain. But he thought that doesn't actually make them the kinds of things that we should give moral rights to, or that we should think of as having moral rights or give legal rights to. But he still thought you shouldn't go kicking your dog. But why does he think that animals don't have that? Because they're not rationally autonomous beings. So he thought that, you know, being a being that can reason and that can direct its life freely on the basis of reason, that is the ground of morality. So animals don't have that, so they don't matter morally directly, right? But don't kick your dog. Why? Well, because he thought if you do go kicking your dog, you know, you're going to make yourself a more harsh being. There are different reasons for thinking that's important, but the one that the folks that advanced this robot rights argument are thinking about is, if you go kicking your dog or other animals, you're going to become sort of more likely to treat other sentient beings that way, like humans. And humans do matter morally. So it's like an indirect, like a bank shot, right, you know, for animals. So, and then it's not too hard to see that robots, you can give an analogous argument for robots. Well, if robots look and act like humans or other animals, then maybe treating them, you know, badly, smashing them, breaking them, is going to make us more harsh toward humans too. And so that's kind of the idea. It's not because robots matter. It's because we think that humans matter, and we think that interacting with robots that look and act like animals could, if we do things poorly, make us more harsh toward humans. So protect the robots so that we protect humans.
So that seems to hinge a lot on how we think of just moral formation, right? And how we think of the sort of things that we do influence the person that we become. Is there any empirical evidence where there's a causal link between treating, just say, inanimate objects that lack sentience badly and us becoming immoral people ourselves.
So in the case of animals?
I guess, yeah, we can start with animals, but then we can work our way down towards things that seem less sentient.
Yeah, I mean, the things that often come up in this conversation are animals, treatment of animals, treatment of robots, and playing violent video games.
Yeah, that was that's it.
Yeah. So with animals, so I'm not an expert in this area. There is, a fair bit of empirical research claiming that there's a causal link between harming animals, especially at early ages, and harming humans later on. There are disputes about this sort of stuff, but it does seem like there's a pretty robust empirical base for making that claim. You know, any kind of empirical research like that, it's always easier to establish correlations between different kinds of events, but harder to get a causal direction. But, so some people will say, look, the people that are, harming animals when they're young and then go on to harm humans, they already had some kind of underlying factor or feature that led them to harm sentient beings. And that might be true. That's probably true for lots of people, but it doesn't, in my mind at least, rule out it's being likely that continuing to harm animals still conditions you to be like less averse to harming humans, or maybe even set you off on that path. So I think that there's decent evidence for that, but there's dispute too.
Yeah, I guess the one that I'm most curious about is video games. Mm-hmm. I grew up in college. I was playing Call of Duty. I think it was 4 my freshman year. I probably spent way too much time doing that my freshman year with Xbox Live and all that. Is that conditioning me to behave poorly in society?
Well, Jordan, I'm just glad you're way over there and not way over here. No. So it's a difficult question. So, and it's a good way to get into talking about the question of whether there's a causal link between harming robots and harming humans. So maybe starting with the Columbine shooting in 99 or 2000, whenever that was, where the shooters were known to have played violent video games. I can't remember what they were playing, but people got really concerned, like playing these hyper-violent video games where you've got blood and guts everywhere and you're shooting people all the time, and it's graphic, is going to desensitize you and cause you to be more likely to be aggressive and cause harm to humans. So there's been a lot of discussion about this. I think mostly what you'll find in discussions in popular media and in academic stuff too is there's no link. Like there's no evidence of a causal link. That's just a discredited claim. So that's not quite how I think about it. So my view on that debate is that we are at an empirical standstill, basically. I think that it's true that there's not any really good empirical evidence showing a causal link, but I think that we should not be surprised that that's the case. So, imagine like a well-designed empirical study that would really test this causal link, right? What you would, say, hey, institutional review board, here's my study. We're going to have a bunch of participants doing long-term, long hours playing a hyper-violent video game, and then we're going to provide them sufficient equipment, we'll set guns out on tables or something, and we'll just watch and see if they pick them up and go assault real people. That's, no one's going to approve that for obvious ethical reasons. So I just think it's really hard to expect that we would have that kind of evidence. We do, according to the American Psychological Association, though, have fairly robust evidence of increased aggression after playing violent video games, which, it takes you at least some way toward thinking it's plausible that there would be a link to violence. Those studies, some of them are not so good. some of them are silly. Some of them are not silly. And so there's some debate about that. I think mostly we're at an empirical standstill with the violent video game debate.
So if someone wanted to say, because of what we know, we should grant robots rights in this case, should they also then be morally obligated to say we should stop production of video games like this?
So there may be something different about video games and robots. So first, robots are embodied physical things that inhabit our space, which does seem to be an important difference that might make a causal link more likely. Like if you're, just getting into the habit of pushing around or kicking human-shaped, human-acting robots in your space, that does seem relevant to thinking that that could make you more likely to do the same with humans. Whereas with video games, it's not so much the case. maybe that'll change in the future with like hyper-realistic VR stuff or whatever.
In your opinion, are robots ever going to be able to be sufficiently complex and enough to have any sort of autonomous rational capacity?
So tell me what you mean. Here are two different versions of what you might be saying. So one version is, will robots or AIs maybe generally ever like truly have minds in the same way that we do? So not just artificial general intelligence in the sense that this robot can perform tasks that, you know, humans can perform, but that it can literally think, have conscious states, intentionality, or is it just the kind of task-oriented question?
I'm thinking the first part.
Yeah, so that's a really hard question. Will robots ever truly have minds? If they do, then when that happens, I think that it's really plausible that they'll have moral status of some kind. Why? Because they'll be, I mean, if you've got a being that truly has a mind, is conscious, is intelligent like us, I mean, you've got a person, basically, and persons matter morally. Is that possible? I don't know. I mean, that's so hard to know. Because it really turns on what you think a mind is. So it turns on questions in the metaphysics of mind.
Yeah.
And, you know, so for example, if you've got a purely physicalist or materialist theory of mind where you think what the mind is just some kind of configuration of material particles, or there are different versions of this type of view, then it seems a bit more plausible that it could happen. If you don't have a view like that, less plausible.
Yeah, no, that makes sense. Because I thinking about my own intuitions about like what a person is, I mean, even if you just strip it down to like more older sorts of theories where, you know, it's just kind of like this something that has the rational capacity, that seems like a robot could, in theory, achieve that if you were able to create it in such a way. I guess my intuition is to think that you would never be able to do it. That the sort of rational capacity that human persons have is utterly unique and unable to be created or replicate it. But I guess I have no way to prove that other than my own intuitions and other various religious commitments that you would kind of like hobble together and to say, I think given these things, you wouldn't be able to achieve this.
Yeah. And those are relevant inputs, I think, into thinking about this. But it is hard to know. I mean, it's not hard to see how someone who's again, a materialist about the mind, who thinks there's no immaterial substance or properties or stuff there. It's just bits and matter in motion. You might think, well, look, if that's just what the brain is, and if we have this kind of mind, then why the heck couldn't it happen with an artificial being? But again, it's a complicated question. Eric Fitzgibel and Mara Garza, two philosophers, have written on this sort of topic. And I think they point out that like, it would be really good to know before we start making robots that could be conscious, right?
I was going to say, it seems like we need to have some sort of ethical framework in place in case we did achieve some sort of ability like this.
I mean, not only that, like, because it seems if we can't tell. So one question is, what is a mind? You know, that's the metaphysics question. That's really hard to know. Another question is, even if we settled on a metaphysics of mind and we all agreed on it or whatever, and it was true, how would we detect whether we've developed a thing that has a mind? That might be really, really hard to know for sure. Maybe not possible. And the trouble is, if we don't know that, well, then we might go making a robot that is conscious, is intelligent, but we didn't think it was. And then we treat the thing like garbage and we do moral wrongs all over the place. That's bad. Or we might create a being that we think is conscious, sentient, intelligent, and all of that, and it's not. And then we go devoting resources to it. And so their point is, like, we should really do philosophy of mind and know. And that's like a massive brake pedal tap here.
Yeah. Even as I think about it, I mean, if you think about all the crazy science fiction stuff, you know, all the robots always turn bad. And they always try to kill humanity and everything, because obviously they look at humanity and think, wow, what a travesty. We need to cleanse ourselves of this there. But even with that in mind, like, there is some level of like intuitive force for me to say, I don't want to create these things because I am afraid of what they could do and become. Is there a moral imperative of some sort to say, like, let's protect ourselves from the possibilities of what these things could do?
Yeah. And that question, if I understand it, Jordan, is even that's separate from the question about giving them rights.
Yeah.
Because, right, right. So there's been a lot of work done on this. So perhaps the best known person is Nick Bostrom at Oxford, who wrote a book about 10 years ago called Superintelligence. So Bostrom thinks that artificial general intelligence of the super intelligent variety, namely that is leaps and bounds beyond human intelligence, is possible and would be really good for lots of reasons, but excuse me, but could be really scary for lots of reasons. And so he argues that, it would be really good to know before we get into that, because we may get to a point where we can't stop a super intelligent being that may not have our best interest at heart. Other people have written on this as well, but it's a tough question because we may not know what a super intelligent AI is capable of without having made one first. And we may not know how to handle it before we make it. But having made it, if it's that far ahead of us in intelligence, we shouldn't expect to be able to control it. So it's kind of a bummer.
I want to shift a little bit from this to one more rights question on robots, because as I'm thinking about another potential reason to not develop these, if we develop robots that have the at least the appearance of these sort of capabilities that human persons have, does that then dehumanize humans? And is that
yeah.
more problematic?
So you might say more about why you think it would, but it is a question that's been raised. So Joanna Bryson is a well-known person in the tech ethics discussion on robot rights, who says that in one of her papers that giving robots legal protections would divert resources away from humans. And she thinks that would effectively dehumanize us. So I think the concern is reasonable. I think a little bit differently about it though. I mean, first, the moral impetus driving this Kant-inspired indirect robot rights argument is really to protect humans. I mean, that's the idea, right? Is you might need to give certain kinds of robots protections because if we don't, humans could come to harm. So that's really all about humanizing humans. So that's not dehumanizing. But even if, like, let's say we did this, we gave robots rights, I do think there is a real worry, speculative one maybe, but a real worry that maybe over time people would come to like start thinking of robots as really being sentient or as really deserving in themselves these rights, you know, as a result of having to treat them kindly all the time and stuff like that, right? And then maybe we start diverting resources to like making robots happy when they really can't be. I think that is an interesting kind of risk. Even still, I don't think that's dehumanizing. I just think it might be mistaken. I mean, when we have to make choices about diverting resources to like animals and making sure they don't suffer too much, that doesn't dehumanize us, even if it costs us.
So I have another worry as I think about potentially building robots or whatever it is that has this sort of capacity. And I think the worry that I had was in my mind and now it's totally gone, but it was a good worry.
Oh, that happens to me a lot. Yeah. I have many published papers that are like that. They don't exist.
Oh man. It's on the tip of my tongue and now I can't think of it, but if we develop these, I don't know, it's gone. It'll come back probably in like 10 minutes.
Okay.
But when I think about the relationship maybe between robots and AI, you know, AI seems to be, ChatGPT, for instance, was really exciting and cool. Like I feel like a year or two ago, everybody was talking about it and now it's sort of like died off. And there is a sense in which some of the new iterations that I've seen, they've been trying to like explain it, construct it, and almost give it some PR as if it is like, you know, an intelligent human person. Is it morally problematic if creators of various robots or different AI sorts of tools are pretending that they have capabilities, intrinsic capabilities even, that they don't actually have?
Well, I mean, if people are pretending, like the developer of some, you know, AI model is pretending that it is sentient or, you know, conscious when the person knows that it isn't, well, then that would be just dishonest. And that's pretty worrisome. I think. It can also be worrisome also because that can change the behavior that we have toward these. Like if we really think these AIs are sentient, it can experience pleasure and pain or things like that. Like we've got moral reasons, it seems clear, or at least many people would think it's clear, to treat them certain ways. And so if they're really not, then we would, you know, that would be bad, right? We would be acting in mistaken things. But I'm not sure that if there's anybody like knowingly misleading people like that.
Yeah. So now I remember my question. And so I'm going to ask it before I forget it. Is there a word? So like we're talking about robots, developing them sufficiently to potentially be companions to people, whatever companion that may be, like a dog or actually another human person. Is there a potential worry for creating something like this that would objectively ultimately harm people? Because it could, when it's a dog, there's a level of people can like clearly see this is not a human person and I'm a human person who needs human companions. Whereas if it's a human-shaped robot that does human sorts of things and looks like a human at that point, maybe they have human-colored skin and everything, could that be ultimately detrimental to humans' ability to just experience the hot quality of life? Maybe they become really depressed when they have these robots. I don't know what it may be, but is that a potential, you know, let's pump the brakes on developing these sorts of things? Because, of course, I think some of that has to do with what you think human persons are and how they're ultimately fulfilled and everything. But is that a legitimate worry that's out there?
Yeah, I mean, I think so, although it would matter like what's driving the worry or like what's the more specific worry beneath it. You know, so the typically when people talk about this, the robot rights argument that I have written about here, they're really just thinking mostly about, you know, if people are going around mistreating robots, they're going to do the same to humans. But you might also have other concerns like, if we make robot friends widely available and they get a lot of adoption, people are going to, you know, it's easier to socialize with an AI or robot because at least the ones to date don't yell at you or get mad at you or betray you or things like that. Sherry Turkle, who's an anthropologist embedded at MIT, has written about this sort of stuff, 20 years ago, 10 years ago. With older technologies, but I think that is a concern. It's tough because there are some pretty compelling cases of people using these new AI chatbots that are built on these language models to have friendship, to have connection in environments where they really just couldn't get that kind of connection, or to kind of talk out thoughts that they didn't feel safe airing elsewhere, things like that, you know, that are pretty like heartbreaking when you hear them. So there are reasons to have these sorts of things. I do think it is a concern though, that, you know, broadly speaking, if we have a society where humans are not getting like standard, like basic human needs, including social needs, if we address that by putting non-minded, you know, beings without minds, to fulfill that need, and they're easier to have, then we just might make the problem a lot worse. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, I can think of a plethora of examples. I don't know what the one that comes to my mind is, like Manti Te'o, if you remember him, and having like a fake girlfriend where he thought this was a real person and it turns out it's not real. And I can only imagine the sort of like cognitive dissonance that would generate and create for somebody like that. Where there is something to me of great intrinsic value that you can't replicate between an actual human person and any other inanimate object, even real objects that are organic and normal. So when I think about tech ethics, like the field is just constantly growing and expanding. How does anyone who's not involved in regularly researching this keep up with the important developments?
That's an interesting question. What are the important developments is another question to even know what they are. I mean, one thing you can do, of course, is to try to, you know, follow people in social media who kind of publicize the stuff or mention things, you know, that follow academics around in one way or another is one way. You know, there are books out there that are geared well for general audiences. One example is Sven Nyholm has a book called This is Technology Ethics that's, you know, geared for, you know, just generally educated people or students to introduce them to these issues. But Yeah, I mean, right now, the fire hose that is the internet and social media makes it difficult to recommend some kind of one source to keep up to date with this stuff. So I feel like I'm at a loss.
Because I just think we have a lot of people who listen to the show. Some people work normal, regular jobs, and but they're in positions of leadership and authority that have technological advances. I mean, I think of my own company where we're thinking about, like, you know, what kind of technology advancements should we onboard and use, and are there any moral requirements for this? Versus people who are listening who are pastors or academics themselves. The pastors obviously have a lot more a reason to think about these sorts of questions, given all the people that they're trying to serve and help. So for those sorts of people, is it just, you know, have a basic framework and that should help you develop, like, engage the various questions that arise, or are there other things that they might be able to do to help themselves think about these things well?
Well, Jordan, those are really good questions. I do feel like I've shrunk down into less than an amateur here in trying to talk about it. So, I mean, one problem is that academics, you know, the ivory tower problem, it's overblown, I think, but it is sort of true that academics get buried in academic work, and we sort of hope that that work trickles into the culture. And that does happen, like in tech ethics, that does happen sometimes, but we don't always work on that kind of communication channel. And so that's kind of a failing, I think, of academia, frankly. So I feel I despair a little at that. Maybe one answer is, you know, just to have people, like, so example, you mentioned a context of like local churches who are trying to provide guidance to their members and others. You know, I mean, maybe it's a good idea to have someone who is sort of familiar and well enough versed with that to communicate those things. So, you know, newspapers will have tech reporters that do a lot of this sort of work. You know, there are tech podcasts out there that are really good. The New York Times has a good one, and others, podcasts like this one here, even though it's not a tech podcast overall. So I don't know. I mean, those are just thoughts that, you know, anybody could have come up with. It's a challenge to communicate. The other thing, Jordan, is that I was going to say a challenge to communicate academic insights to culture more broadly, but like academic insights, a funny word. I mean, there's like all these debates. No doubt there will be soon people, you know, publishing stuff disagreeing with what I argued. So, like synthesizing all of that and communicating it to the general public is difficult. Yeah.
Well, you know, you worked on the Honesty Project, right? For several years, I think. And Christian Miller, I find him extremely, like, it's amazing where he's publishing in all sorts of like normal contexts. How does he do that?
Oh, man. Yes. Christian is an amazing person. He says, hello, by the way. So, here is the answer cannot be that we should all become Christian Miller, because I think that's impossible. He's super impressive and productive in that way. But it would be really good if more academics like Christian would publish popular versions of their works, right? So I felt some pressure to start doing that myself, pressure just because, you know, it doesn't do a whole lot of good for people more broadly if these things stay in these academic journals, right? So I think that is a good thing to say here. That puts some of the burden back on us academics, which I'm happy to say we deserve. Yeah.
Well, maybe we can revise all the rules for tenure to include a popular trade level book of some sort.
There we go.
And that help get you through on those things. So
I'm all for it.
For those who are interested in following along with your work and the stuff you publish, I think if I remember correctly, you have a website. Are there other places that they can go to catch up on all that?
Yeah, thank you. So you can go to my website, which I'm sure there'll be a link provided or something for that. But you can go there. That'll have links to my published works and stuff I've been teaching. Some of those will take you to copies of these. So even if the paper is like under embargo or whatever with an academic journal, I'll usually always have a penultimate version, which is pretty much the same thing, just with different formatting.
Well, I appreciate you taking the time to talk with us about all this. This is a lot of fun and interesting. Lots of useful questions here to explore and expand on. So Tobias, thanks. And I look forward to all the stuff that you continue to work on. there in your own research, as well as we didn't talk anything about Leibniz, but maybe sometime in the future we can talk about him and all of the interesting things that he talks about and thinks about. So that would be a full episode in itself, I'm sure.
Sounds great, Jordan. Thanks so much for having me. It's been a pleasure to be here.
Yeah. So everybody who's been listening, thanks for tuning in to the only analytic Baptist and confessional podcast on the planet. And we'll talk to you all soon.
How do people feel about getting Big Fitness Energy and Planet Fitness for $15 a month?
They feel as thrilled as a kid the first summer they're tall enough to ride the roller coaster.
That's right. When you join Planet Fitness right now, you get access to tons of equipment and free fitness training in a clean and spacious club. Don't wait. Join the judgment-free zone today for that all-day energy. Download the free Planet Fitness app and join today for $15 a month.
Hurry. Deal ends September 12th. Join today for $15 a month.
See Home Club for details.
Get 15% off a set of BrakeMess Select, Select Pro, or Import Direct brake pads and two rotors now at O'Reilly Auto Parts.
Oh, O'Reilly Auto Parts.